Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Ha Jin, whose latest novel is A Free Life. Earlier novels include War Trash and the National Book Award-winning Waiting. Ha Jin, A Free Life is a very long novel concerning a Chinese man who comes to America wanting to be a poet and winds up running a restaurant. There are parallels with your own life, and there are differences between your life and the life of Nan Wu. I understand that the genesis of the book is that a writer named Jennifer Rose told you about a guy who managed a restaurant but wanted to be a poet.
Yeah.
Why did that resonate? Was it because you kind of wanted to tell your own story but not tell your own story?
You know, at the time, I think I just decided to write in English. But I didn't know really what to do with my life exactly yet. And Jennifer Rose showed me the book of poems by the guy who owned the restaurant and self-published poems. And that showed me that the guy, in a way, was facing a similar problem, had to survive at the same time, had to really follow his own heart. Of course, he must have been having a difficult time. So that's why it resonated with me.
When you began thinking about that book, had you written The Crazed or War Trash yet?
No. The Crazed was my first book, but I couldn't finish it until many books later I had the ability, the skills to do that book. War Trash was way afterward, because that Jennifer Rose showed me the book in the winter of 1992. 15 years ago, yes.
So this book, A Free Life, had been in your mind for a long time?
For a long time. The actual writing started in 2000, but over the years I kept notes preparing for this project.
So you knew at one time when you were sufficiently comfortable in English you could write the book?
That's part of it. Also, I knew I did not understand the immigrant experience. I would have to live through the process to understand the complexities and nuances of this process.
As your life continued from 92 through to 2000 or shortly thereafter, you could incorporate some of your own history into the book as you lived it, in a way, through the notes.
Yeah, I think in a way, because this book, it's unlike a book set in China. This book, the details, the references, they had to be factual, because this is about American experience. And so as a result, everything must be accurate, and I have to be very careful. I have to know enough. So that's why at the micro level, there are some autobiographical elements. But the big story is not mine. His life is much closer to a common immigrant's life, whereas I have had a much more fortunate life. In fact, there's a guy here. His friend, Dick Harrison, you know, he was a poet teaching at Emory University. In fact, I had his job for 8 years. I was much more fortunate.
Let's talk a little about Nan Wu and his wife, Ping Ping.
Yeah.
Are these people you actually, you know and transposed? How close is Nan Wu to you, let's say?
At the micro level, sure, there are some personal experience or something I really knew. But most of the characters, I combined different people, and not just one, you know, based on one person, combine a few people and create a character. Some of them, in fact, pure creation, like Dick Harrison, there's no such a person originally. So that was really created a character. Most of the time, I would say I've combined different people to create one character.
The poet Sam Fisher kind of reminded me of Allen Ginsberg a little.
Maybe, but I never met him, but I heard a lot of stories of him, and also I knew friends of his, good friends of his, sure. But not that again, you know, with a lot of photos, the apartment arrangement. I had friends who were gay. I saw, you know, how the lifestyle, so I knew poets too, in Boston, not in New York. So it was partly created as well.
Speaking about the poet's life, Nan Wu is struggling to be a poet and sees it as a higher art form, yet the poets in the book in particular, they're all just trying to get rich and famous.
I know, sure.
Is this what you found in the world of poetry?
In a way, poetry world is not that pure. So that's why at some point, Then we was disappointed, and because there was earthly strife, not artistic strife only among the poets. I think that's why toward the end he would prefer to be isolated.
So that he can stay pure.
Relatively speaking. But he was lucky, you know, because at one point his friend Dick Harrison said, "You compare with me, you are lucky. You have family, you have a business, a solid pace. Even if you fail, you lose everything, your family would still stay with you and love you." So that was a revelation to him.
The end of the book contains poems written by Nan Wu.
Yeah.
And you've written poetry yourself. How do you guide yourself to write poems? It seems to me like this is sort of an idea that came from Dr. Zhivago.
Sure.
But in this case, you're writing not merely poetry, but poetry seen through someone else's eyes. How do you do that?
Originally, I didn't plan to add poems, and I thought the extracts from his poetry journal would be enough for the epilogue. Then, after a few drafts, I realized the guy would appear like a crazy man. I had to show he had talent, which was stunted, diminished by the immigration experience. So that I decided to add the poems. Then I was aware of the disadvantage, that is, people might associate this book with Dr. Zhivago in structure. But there was no way to cut corners, so that's how I decided to write the poems in response to the novel, through his eyes. There were two or three pieces that had been published already, but I had not included them in any book. So I used those, but the rest, 20-some poems, were written just from his point of view.
Would you be comfortable if there were a book of poetry and all of these poems appeared under your own name, without reference to A Free Life?
Some of them, I don't think so. Some of them really is because it really reflect his own experience. And also there are a few poems, they are kind of formal verse that illustrated his struggle, his trying hard to learn and the technique, the skill in English versification. I think most of them I would feel comfortable about, but not every one of them.
Well, Hodgson, you said that in some of the specifics there's reference to your own life, but not in the general story, and I want to kind of look at some of those.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the book, Nan Wu goes to the airport along with his wife and meets their son, Tao Tao.
Yeah.
And in reading about you, it seemed like his experience meeting Tao Tao at the airport was very similar to your experience meeting your son when...
Yeah, that was close. That was close. Not exactly the same, but close, yes. Yes, when I talk about big stories, things, major events, like I did not drop out of graduate school. I never lived in New York City. I never worked in a Chinese restaurant, and I never returned to China. So there are a lot of big events that are absent from my life.
Well, how did you do the research on the day-to-day struggle of owning and operating a Chinese restaurant and being a chef?
See, I visited a lot of local restaurants in the Atlanta area. In fact, I also knew a few owners of restaurants. Over time, I accumulated. Also, I read a lot about the business.
And you said it near Atlanta because when you were taking your notes, that's where you were living?
Yeah, that's again, you see, for technical reasons, I have to know the details and the experiences intimately so that I can hold the book in my mind. So that's why I decided to stay close to the things I was sure of.
Why did you bring in the element of adoption of a Chinese baby? Their best friends adopt a Chinese baby.
See, that's another thing, because they don't, the Wus, they didn't live in just in, among Chinese or minorities. There are a lot of, you know, whites and other kind of ethnic groups. So I wanted to figure out a way how to combine the other groups. So one way was to have a white couple as their friends who eventually adopted a Chinese baby. That was common. There are thousands of Chinese babies adopted in this country.
There's a lot of talk there, and also in your other books about how the Chinese bureaucracy seems intent on being there just to stop people from doing anything.
Sure, sure. It's purely all the frustration, all the oppression, very often are for no purpose at all.
I'd like to talk a little about the Chinese characters who are come to America. I don't remember all of their names. I know one is Danny.
Yeah, Danny.
And he goes back.
Yes.
He goes back. He's a writer.
Eventually became a writer.
Is he based on anybody?
No. I don't think he's based on anybody at all.
You have these three characters.
Yes.
Dunning. Then you have another character,
Bao,
who's who's a writer who becomes a painter.
Yes.
And then you have an old man. Nonthinks has sold out at somewhere along the line. How do you feel about someone who comes over to America and then caves in and goes back?
That was very common. A lot of people returned. Some of them then came back to the United States. Immigrants in Canada did the same. Even more, they returned to China and came back. I think it was a big struggle. A lot of people were intimidated by the immigration, by putting down your roots and make a new start in a new place. That's understandable. I think also the act of returning, that means people tend to accept the finitude of life. But the fact is, once you have left the place, you have left. Because the place would change, you will change. It would be impossible to go to the same place, go back to the same place as the same person. That's a common sense.
It also seems that one of Nan's complaints seems to be that Americans are less angry than Chinese. They're less apt to get angry at other people, and they seem less judgmental.
I think so. I think
really?
So. Yeah, the thing that the problem is, that's me, you know, who is good, who's bad. I think because of the order, the civil order, I think social order really have ways to allow people let out their steam. Whereas in China, very often people get frustrated so easily and then they get bad-tempered and outraged. And very often they would take it out on others, randomly sometimes even. So I think that's a fact. That is a fact.
It's clear in his return visit, his experience with his mother and with his uncle.
Yeah.
These people are making demands that no American would make of another American particularly.
Sure. That's, again, the family relationship is in China is different. A lot of parents, I think conventionally, parents would view their children as kind of investment or own the children. But nowadays that has changed. But, of course, Nan's parents, they were the older generation. Also, I think beyond everything else, it was impossible for him to communicate with his parents because they could not understand his struggle, his bitterness, or his intention at all.
Do you have similar experiences when talking with your relatives? You can't go back there, but, I mean, just in terms of talking with your relatives?
Relatives and friends. After some years, it became very hard to communicate.
How does learning English play into that? Because English, of course, has cultural implications that go well beyond just a simple translation.
Of course. And also, if American English means more, because very often it represents a power behind, a superpower. And to the Chinese, it can be also undermining power. Subversive power, and sure. That's why I think you are right. It's not just the instrument, a tool you use, and there's so much alienation in using writing another language. Originally, I was not aware of any of these, but gradually I could feel it.
Then switching back and forth, is sequences, whenever the characters speak Chinese, it's in italics, and that's more or less translated from the Chinese. But is it really possible then, given whatever cultural implications are in Chinese, to adequately convey meaning just by translating to simple English sentences?
It's hard. In fact, that because when they speak Chinese, that means they don't speak English.
Right.
So it's artifice. But I learned this from a great American novel called Sleep. In which Yiddish is presented as the elegant, lucid English. in italics. So that I think a number of other writers, for instance, Gishin did a similar thing. So there has been, technically, there has been tradition in American literature of presenting another language in different kind of typography.
Writing in English about things that are happening 99% in Chinese would seem to be easier than writing English about events where you're intermingling the two languages.
Much easier, and the technique is very different as well. Also, I think, for instance, if I write a book like The Crazed, basically I occupied a privileged space because the readers had very little knowledge of what I was talking about. So my job would be not to abuse the privilege and try to be truthful. But nobody speaks English in a book like that. So everything was created by myself. But whereas in a book like A Free Life, there are native speakers and non-native speakers, so different kind of immigrants, and a lot of references, and they are daily existence. Everybody knows. So, yes, the technique, the challenge are different.
The other problem I could see is since you're trying to cram so much of the immigrant's life into a book, there would be a tendency to almost make minor characters stick figures rather than real people beyond that. Did you have to fight that to try to create real characters out of the people, say, who went back?
In the craft of fiction, we have two kinds of characters. That's conventionally they call the round character and the flat character. These terms are made by Ian Foster. Both kind of characters are useful. And the round characters were usually for the main characters. Those should be round characters. They should have different dimensions and also change. Flat characters, very often most minor characters, you don't have space. You don't have enough attention for them. Ideally speaking, everybody should appear as like real people. But I think it's very difficult because a novel is a piece of work. It's not real life. Look at Charles Dickens. And he used a lot of flat characters. But they are there, have their own function. And so I think most novelists, when we work on a book, perhaps we pay so much attention to the main characters. That's where, that's where the book will stand. Whether it fail or succeed, it really would depend on the main characters. So very often the minor characters are not round characters. Sometimes they are put there as flat characters on purpose.
And you did that in this book?
Some of them.
Yeah. Was some of that just so that Nanwu could bounce off his own ideas about what it's like to be in America?
Sure, and also that's part of it. Also, I think, when we decided on the cast of characters, you can't see this group, you have one bad person, you have to have some good one there as counterbalance, mainly. It's not because they're there just to show them as a complicated human being, because you don't have enough room for them. So there are different reasons. I think very often balance, counterbalance, or the complexity of the community. So that those factors very often decided the cast of the characters.
Nan Wu's political views regarding China, are they pretty much yours?
Not all, but some of them, I would say, yes.
You're listening to an interview with Ha Jin, whose latest novel is A Free Life. Toward the end of the book, Ha Jin, Nan Wu goes back to China. And I know that you went to university in Harbin, and you've not been back. He talks about all the changes between the Harbin of then and the Harbin of now.
Yeah.
How did you get that right?
I follow news and also follow a lot of writings. A lot of Chinese who return, then they will write, on the internet, on newspapers, or even books. They talk a lot about their impression. And also there are pictures, a lot of pictures.
Do you want to go back?
For a private visit, yes, but not to live, because I am an immigrant here. Yes, for a private visit, sure. Yeah.
And you can't because?
I think I should be able now, because I'm a U.S. citizen. But before I became a citizen, I didn't have a passport. I couldn't have my passport renewed. So as a result, I could not travel outside the United States. But now I think I should be able. But because my books have been banned, and I don't feel comfortable at this moment.
They banned all your books?
Waiting came out and then went out of print. And the others, no, the others were not allowed to be published.
Why do you think that is? Just because they're critical?
Politically sensitive, and in fact, I have 5 book contracts with a Shanghai publisher. They announced last year 3 times that they were going to bring out my books. And they sent my story collection under the red flag to the censorship department in Shanghai. But the first one was that book was shut down. So the whole project had to be abandoned. And that's what they told me. In fact, a book like The Crazed and Wall Trash, from the very beginning, they said, we won't touch them. Impossible. And so basically, they wanted to bring out the less politically sensitive books, but even those couldn't go through the censorship.
Have your books been translated into Chinese anyway, into Mandarin or Cantonese?
To Mandarin, and they all published, all fiction books have been published by a Taiwanese publisher. So I think my books are well received in the Chinese diaspora.
Do you have any reports of people who've smuggled copies and read them in China?
Yes, I think there are pirate editions. There are pirate editions in China. And again, the similar situation, even those underground publishers, they would not touch The Crazed and Wall Trash because politically they don't want to be responsible for that.
So it's highly unlikely that even an underground version of
Wall
Trash.
They wouldn't touch those. They would do Waiting, you know, select the stories in the pond.
Well, let me ask you then, since after finishing A Free Life, I began War Trash. It's about the Korean War and POW in the Korean War. Early on in the book, the POWs are from both nationalist China and communist China. It was always my understanding of the Korean War that it was the communists who fought with the Koreans against the UN/US. So why are all these nationalists being POWs?
Originally, they surrendered themselves to the communists. So they became part of the Red Army. Then the communists would send some units to the front, where often it's the communists, the nationalists, the former nationalist army. Those members were sent to the front. Basically, were to be consumed first. So they resented it. And also, once they are in imprisonment, the nationalist government in Taiwan was very eager to get hold of the former soldiers because they didn't have enough manpower compared with the communist China. And that's why the struggle became very intense between the communists and the nationalists, try to get hold of the men to humiliate the other side.
When you were growing up, what did you hear about the Korean War?
My father was an officer, so we knew that those returnees, those returned POWs, were Saima criminals. They were in disgrace. My family once lived in Heilongjiang province. There were some kind of farms, state farms. So there were a lot of former POWs from the Korean War and work there. It's very remote, and work there labor camp, in a way.
What was the official word on what happened in the war?
That was a huge victory for China. The propaganda, the official version was really it was a huge victory, and the United States, as the number one power, was defeated. So that's what, when I came to the States, we know this is it's a draw. It's not really neither side really won the war at all. So that got me interested in this subject. In addition, also, I saw American POWs return welcome as a hero. That was really a shock to me.
Then in terms of doing your own research, it must have been a bit eye-opening to find that...
Sure. Especially a lot of photos. And so many Chinese soldiers were killed. Sometimes a mountain slope would cover these bodies. Really very, very shocking.
When you're in China, how aware are you when you were growing up, or how aware were your parents that what you were receiving was so one-sided and that, in fact, a propaganda machine was at work?
In China, I I didn't know anything because I didn't have the reference, external reference. As a result, most like others, we tend to believe what we were told. My parents, I think they were, at some point, they were staunch communists. Of course, later they were not that, not firm believers anymore. But they used to believe in the official version of things. While I was in the Chinese army, I think most people, everything was clear, black and white. There were very little nuances because soldiers were not allowed to think in a complicated way. So as a result, we did believe a lot what we were told.
As you're in America and you're watching, say, Fox News, which presents its own propaganda, are we wrong to look at that kind of propaganda and compare it to, say, Chinese propaganda, or is what you grew up with so overwhelmingly one-sided that even Fox News looks democratic?
Sure. I mean, by comparison, Fox World looks really democratic. At least there are people to challenge it.
Right.
You can condemn it openly. But in China, even nowadays, and there are always official versions. You cannot go beyond that. And a lot of reporters and journalists get arrested regularly. A lot of editors get fired regularly. So it's a different nature. It's a really different kind of censorship.
Well, when you're looking at the United States and seeing things the Bush administration has done, I mean, I'm sure we have a long way to go to get to what China is, but does that bother you to see America shifting too?
Yes, I do. But in this book, A Free Life, I describe so much of the landscape. And the land itself almost become part of the character. And that was from the very beginning in the immigrant literature, especially literature written by Willa Cather and some early European immigrants. Land itself is a character, a benign, permanent force. So I wanted to bring that back into this novel. And also that implies the land, there is a difference between the land and the government and the current administration, and because the latter, the administration is always a momentary thing that will go, whereas the land itself, I think, is a permanent, a good force. I think maybe it's a romantic idea, but it's essential.
To that degree, then, do you miss, let's putting it in that context, how much do you miss the land of China?
See, I was in a different situation because my father was an officer, so we moved a lot. We moved around in the northeast of China, everywhere basically. And in a way, I do feel a kind of attachment to the landscape, but it's very similar to the Midwest. In fact, I remember when I went to Minnesota, I could smell the soil that reminded me of the land in the northeast of China. Specifically, Heilongjiang province near Harbin.
Both the main character of War Trash and Nan Wu walk around with dictionaries. Did you do that?
sure. I mean, most immigrants, especially if you seriously want to learn English, that's a common process. And not just me, I think in American literature, immigrant literature, that has been a tradition too.
Why did, in War Trash, why did that character have Uncle Tom's Cabin? That was not the book that you hung out with, right?
No. See, in China, American literature, the whole, was never banned. There were always writers available, such as Steinbeck, Jack London, or Henry Lester Hughes, and Howard Fast, and Michael Gold, and Theodore Dreiser. These were viewed as, also Whitman, as proletarian writers, progressive writers. So Uncle Tom's Cabin is anti-slavery novel. It's always viewed as a progressive, anti-slavery literature. So that was entirely plausible for a soldier specializing in English to carry a copy in the original. In fact, I read in a book written by American prisoners seized by the Chinese army. One of them said, and he said he read almost all Charles Dickens provided by the Chinese in the camp. And he had never thought there was so much poverty in London, in England.
I don't know if you've read the works of Peter Hessler, who lives in China and now writes for the New Yorker.
Yes, yes. Louboutin.
When reading something like that, An American's Experience in China, how does that resonate for you?
I think Peter Hessler's book, I think he's a wonderful writer, and also he's very honest. And unlike some Americans who went to China basically as tourists or some experts, he mixed with the Chinese. He lived among them, even fought with them. So that's why I think his book has kind of earthiness and honesty that might be absent from other books on China.
Hajin, how do you feel about what's happening with the Three Rivers Gorge and the dam?
It was a disaster. Even the official, the government now, they realize it was a disaster, and they have begun telling people something was wrong with the dam. I think mentally, psychologically, preparing the population for a bigger disaster. It's not coming yet, but something's terribly wrong. Environment apparently was damaged, and nobody can say it was a success. Even the government, nobody. It was terrible.
Did you ever go to the Three Gorges?
No, I haven't. But there was common sense. Nature was not something like you can tamper at random.
And moving millions and millions of people.
And towns and villages destroyed. It's crazy.
Do you think because of that an environmental movement might begin to grow in China?
Even a moment like that, that would be controlled by the government. But the situation is the government was aware that this is really a matter of survival. It's not whether you like it or not. They have to take the environmental issues very, very seriously. But again, to what degree they can correct the situation and recover some part of the loss, that is uncertain because there are so much corruptions.
The pro-democracy movement of 1989 said that at least there is a large percentage or some percentage of Chinese who want things changed. And I know that there was more or less crackdown after that.
Yeah.
Is there a possibility for China actually to become more democratic on its own? Or do you think that this, what we're seeing now with this mix of capitalism, communism, and a relatively repressive government is just going to continue forever or what?
I wouldn't say forever, but it will be a very slow process, maybe four or five generations. But I think if people and other countries and the whole world try to give some pressure on the Chinese authorities and also try to have more exchange with the Chinese people and people understand the nature of democracy better, I think that process can be sped up. Otherwise, just on its own, I think it takes many, many generations.
Do you think Americans could do more?
Sure. Just by keeping contact, and even the business part, and not just to make money, but of course, but I think to have more exchanges, and also I think allow more Chinese to come here to visit and see what the States is really like, what America is really like. I think step by step, most Chinese, especially the younger generations, their minds would be much more open.
What about the idea of more Chinese literature coming to America?
Sure. There are two kinds, basically, classical Chinese literature and the contemporary. Classical Chinese literature, it's there, you know, extremely valuable, sure. But contemporary, the problem is with that is, I think not just here, people don't try. The Chinese government has been trying very hard. In fact, the Writers Association, they have started a project in which 100 pieces of modern contemporary Chinese literature would be translated into major Western languages. But the problem is how many of them are really good. Personally, I would prefer to see like half a dozen great books. And we don't need so many here. Just really great books, great literature. That will mean much more. It seems to me they are in a rush. I think it's, again, literature is viewed as a kind of soft power. China is at the stage where the country has so much economic power and other powers, but the government really want to see the soft power would increase. But culture is a different thing. It's not, you cannot just spend money on it to develop it, like build a building or a factory. So that's the situation, and they don't know how to really to create more soft power.
I also notice that some of the great Chinese directors have turned away from looking at contemporary ideas, and they're just creating these big martial arts epics.
See, the things I think that behind this, there's a censorship here, because when you write about dead people, you work in the the annals of the past. Sure, politically that cannot be very offensive, but it can be also a way to consume the Chinese creative talent. Really, it's a sad situation.
No matter how well done Secret of the Golden Flower is or Hero, these are minor works by major artists.
Sure, and from the very beginning, there is very little promise there. Like if you're an architect, you don't build just a small bridge. You want to make a big thing, right? You have to have a major design, really a big piece of work. But in the very beginning, very often, a lot of these projects had very little promise.
The United States invasion and occupation of Iraq. Mm-hmm. Not long ago, I spoke with Orhan Pamuk, the Turkish writer,
sure.
Won the Nobel
yeah.
Prize. And he told me that the Bush war had really damaged democracy in Turkey and damaged the way people in Turkey look toward the West. In other words, if the West can't get it right and screws up, they're going to look more toward religion, their own religion, and authoritarian ideas rather than looking toward Western ideas of democracy and freedom.
Sure.
Do you think Iraq has had any similar effect on China?
Sure, sure. A lot of Chinese would perceive the United States as aggressors, as invaders. That was very easy for the authorities to describe the United States as invaders. That's common sense. Again, a lot of people just talk that way, view the U.S. as aggressors. And the ramifications, the consequences, I think we did not expect. It's not just the Middle East, the whole world. And I think not now, even perhaps now, we haven't seen all the consequences yet.
It feeds into their propaganda.
Yes. They don't need to do much just by mentioning a few facts. Very easily to portray the United States as the negative, violent, unreliable, irresponsible forces.
Ha Jin, after writing an epic about life of an immigrant in a free life, have you begun thinking about working on your next novel?
No, I'm working. In fact, I'm doing homework now. I'm working on a collection of short stories set in the United States. Because most writers would start with short stories, then a novel. I haven't written any short stories set in the States, so for me this was something, homework I need to do.
And you have ideas for other novels, though, right?
Yeah, I do. But, a book, it takes forever to finish.
Well, you were working on parts of Free Life when you were writing more trash, right?
Yes, the process, publishing process is a long process. Very often you send in a manuscript just to be considered for acceptance. It takes a few months, half a year. That was normal. So during the time, what do you do? You work on another project. So, yes, there are an overlapping period.
One final question. Has Hollywood or Taiwan or Hong Kong been interested in turning any of your books into film?
Waiting has been talked for 7 years. And in fact, recently, I think there was a joint venture between an American movie company and a Chinese movie company. They want to make a movie based upon Waiting, but it's uncertain.
You've been listening to an interview with Ha Jin, whose latest novel is A Free Life. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.